Welcome to ID the Future, a podcast about intelligent design and evolution.
I'm Tom Gilson, and today's episode continues a conversation between Uncommon Knowledge host Peter Robinson and philosopher David Berlinski, author of the celebrated new book Human Nature. Here in part two of the interview, the two discuss evolutionary sociology, and from there, the famous Regensburg Address by Pope Benedict XVI.
You recently, in Inference, the International Review of Science, which you helped to edit, you published a review of something that somebody worked very hard at and it was a clear effort to achieve something good. And that object was a book called Blueprint, and it is a book by the Yale sociologist and physician, Nicholas Christakis, whose name I may be mispronouncing, but I tried hard to get it right. Nicholas Christakis, and the name of the book is Blueprint. And Christakis says, we live at a difficult moment. Europe is in turmoil, more turmoil coming, immigration pressures, rise of China, tensions between China and the United States. And it is in the air that we are predisposed toward violence and disorder because of evolutionary pressures. But let me, Nicholas Christakis, produce a book showing the way that we are predisposed to cooperate, to form groups, to work for the good as well by evolution. The book runs to more than 500 pages, but the argument in brief, and I quote it from Blueprint, natural selection has shaped our lives as social animals. You should be happy about this. Priming our capacity for love, friendship, cooperation, learning, and even our ability to recognize the uniqueness of other individuals. All this from natural selection. We each carry within us an evolutionary blueprint for making a good society. Close quote. And I have to tell you that the tenor of your review is one in which you are just not impressed. Why is that?
Well, divide through those statements by natural selection, you're left with rather an optimistic credo. We are, by and large, disposed to certain worthwhile ends, and we have the means to pursue them. Yeah, that's true, sometimes. The negation is just as true if you look at the 20th century, and all the virtues that he expresses, for example, cooperation, can be put to very nefarious uses. Look, the Nazi Party was a marvelous engine of cooperation. All those Nazis cooperated with one another running death camps. Cooperation is relatively neutral. The Gulag couldn't have been maintained without cooperation either. China couldn't be maintained under Mao in the 50s and 60s without large-scale cooperation. This hasn't passed the level of the bromide, something one swallows and expects some relief for heartburn. The heartburn goes far too deep for this kind of analysis, the heartburn of the 20th century. And I'm not talking about indigestion either. I'm talking about heartburn. And we have very little by way of understanding what happened in the 20th century. Look, we're talking about 220 million excess deaths between 1914 and 1945. That's not something that can be relieved by calling to mind our powers of cooperation. If anything, there was far too much cooperation during those years. Very little love, far too much cooperation. So these offer little by way either of analysis, penetrating analysis of the sort, for example, that Hannah Arendt provided. Mm-hmm.
Hannah Arendt and the Banality of Evil and the Sources of Totalitarianism.
All of her books, at least she recognized the magnitude of the question that needed to be answered, which was why, after the relatively optimistic 19th century, was there a descent into barbarism in the 20th century? We don't know.
And Charles Darwin doesn't help us answer it.
Doesn't help much.
By the way, the technique of argument that in Blueprint, you write this. The argument, that is Christakis' argument in Blueprint, the argument is unvarying and proceeds from the common feature of social life to the gene acting as its presumptive cause. Yet we can complete no connection between any particular gene and any phenotypic trait.
It's true, isn't it?
All right.
By a connection, I mean a complete causal connection. And it is remote in time, the time at which we're able to complete a chemical or a biochemical connection. We have no idea what takes place. I mean, you learn to walk, I learn to walk. You can say there's a gene for walking because we didn't learn it, but that doesn't tell you any more than that you learn to walk.
David, in your review of Blueprint, the book by Christiakis, you sum up your own view by writing this. If the blueprint for our social behavior circumscribes the terrible societies of the 20th century, it's too broad to be of interest. And if it is determined by the human genome, it's too narrow to be of hope. We must look to other sources for our common humanity. Which led me to wonder, what would David make of a certain document that I find compelling but difficult? And that is the address on the relation between faith and reason of then Pope Benedict the 16th at 2006 at his old University of Regensburg, Germany. And I have no idea. I'm doing this because we're friends and because I genuinely want to hear what you have to make of this, what you make of this. So, and I may have to read a couple of longish passages to set it up. The Pope sets up the problem. Here's the problem, part one. Western thought has reached a point at which, quote, only the kind of certainty resulting from the interplay of mathematical and empirical elements can be considered scientific. By its very nature, this method, that is the scientific method as currently understood in the West, by its very nature, this method excludes the question of God, making that question appear unscientific or pre-scientific, close quote. And you come out of your chair and say, of course it excludes the question of God. God has nothing to do with science. Or is that not quite your response?
Maybe it should be. What I do think is that if you look at the great theories in physics, that's really where the richest tradition lies that has some relevance to the world as it is, as opposed to mathematics.
Physics explaining observed reality, the richness of reality.
Physics explaining the world, let's put it that way.
All right.
Mathematics explains plenty of things, but I think that should be put aside as a separate case for the time being. But neither the assumptions nor the conclusions of any of the great four physical theories, Newtonian mechanics, Einstein relativity, quantum mechanics, quantum field theory, make any claims about the existence of God. They just don't
mention
it.
They just leave it out.
Just leave it out. That's either a good thing or a bad thing, but the fact is incontrovertible. These are not theological documents. Fine, treat them for what they are. They're physical theories. But don't argue, as so many people do, that their implicit conclusion is anti-theistic. It's not. There's no conclusion you can draw from special relativity that would indicate God does not exist, or that he does.
All right. Okay, fair enough. And I'm even following you, I believe. The problem, part two. The pressure on Europe from the Islamic world. Again, I'm quoting Benedict XVI, the world's profoundly religious cultures see the exclusion of the divine from the universality of reason, that is, we can talk about anything but not God, as an attack on their most profound convictions, a reason which is deaf to the divine and which relegates religion to the realm of subcultures. That's what you were saying, what you were describing, this notion of physics as disproving God, or in one way or another condescending to the religious, that relegates religion to the realm of subcultures, is incapable of entering into the dialogue of cultures, close quote. We have a problem. We Westerners have shoved any notion of religious thought, any sense of the transcendent, off to the children's table. And other cultures, and in particular Islam, from which the West is under pressure, aside from anything else, just look at the population figures. The population of Europe over the next half century will decline. The population of the Islamic world will grow by some hundreds of millions. That's a problem. And we can't talk to them, let alone sorting out some kind of working relationship. We can't talk to them because they take religion seriously. You admit that he's framed a real problem? Admit, at Grant, you'd agree. How would you see the problem? You're not impressed.
I wouldn't express the problem in the way that he did. I think we're perfectly capable of discussing things with Islam. We're less capable of entertaining a whole category of arguments that we used to entertain with considerable interest, that is, theological arguments.
Right.
And theology has more or less disappeared as part of the Western curriculum, part of the Western habit of thought. But it has not completely disappeared. Look.
Why has it disappeared? And you're talking about what, over a century and a half, 2 centuries? What are you talking about? Since the French Revolution?
200 years, maybe since the French Revolution.
All right.
Because of the, first of all, there are two parts to the disappearance. The enormous success of a secular culture very obviously breeds an expectation that its fundamental assumptions must be correct if it produced so much material abundance, so much relative absence of scarcity. And the second part is the great difficulty of entertaining very abstract arguments about the existence and providence of God in the world as it is, without the apparatus of modern science to buttress those arguments. That is, we feel a distinct inadequacy in making any claims about the real world without having an enormous apparatus, like a backpack, saying, I'll look in the backpack and special relativity tells me that the ontological proof is correct. Well, no, it's not going to tell you that. You have to address it on its own and naked. And that's something very few people want to do anymore. It is temporary. It's just a fashion. Theological arguments are not going to disappear, and the fundamental questions they address are not going to disappear either. You see certain signs of the wind. For example, the ontological argument in philosophy, which has been current since the 12th, in fact, the late 11th century, has not disappeared. And the greatest logician of the 20th century, Kurt Gödel, made it manifest in his own way.
He did. Okay, so explain that, the Gödel insufficient, what is it called? I've never understood it.
Anselm argued in the 11th, 12th century that God is a being greater than which none other can be conceived. And he concluded, therefore, he must exist. Well, why? Because if he didn't exist, you could conceive something still greater, namely a being who did exist. Oh, well, everybody said, you know, that couldn't be right. Bertrand Russell said, oh, my God, what was he? The trouble is, it's very hard to refute. It's devilishly difficult to really come up with a convincing explanation of where he went wrong. And in the 1960s, Kurt Gödel worked it all out in terms of modal logic. And he showed his results to Dana Scott, among others. And it's provoked an enduring controversy ever since then. An indication in a small subfield that these issues retain an intellectual vitality denied them by mainstream science. Does this mean the argument is correct? I have no idea.
You have no idea, but it's all right.
But the argument from design is also making a reappearance. It's also making a reappearance, inconclusively, granted. But it hasn't gone away, and it won't go away because we're too impressed by the facts to avoid an encounter with any theory that seems to explain them.
That's that actually. So, Newton, Einstein, Max Planck, the physical theories they come up with, you don't find something, you don't have the feeling that there's something else trying to push into it. But when you discuss, as you have just discussed, evolution, and you say, wait a minute, what could possibly account for the complexity of life? Wait a minute. Even grant that that life proceeds by way of mutation, it doesn't look as though it can be entirely random. It looks as though it knows where it wants to go. You feel as though just on the other side of the wall, there must be something there that's intelligent, that's there's a being, there's something there. You don't feel that in physics, do you? And that argument from design is, look at this, it must mean something.
You hear a murmur no matter what you study.
Oh, you do?
Oh, I think so. You look at physics long enough and the murmur becomes quite insistent. Why are the laws of nature the way they are? Why are the constants, the parameters fixed for the values that they happen to have? These may be bad questions, they may be good questions, they may be unanswerable or undecidable questions, but they are questions. They are questions, and the insistent murmur is heard whenever you push a discipline to a certain degree and with a certain effort of the will.
So that wasn't Einstein's comments. We have a few comments in which he mentions God. There's certain theories of which he disapproves because God wouldn't play dice with the universe.
The old one doesn't throw dice.
The Der old Alta. One doesn't throw dice. Der Alte. But that, he wasn't just being coy. He felt it.
No. Einstein was given over to expressing a lot of apophthegms, pithy thoughts.
All right. We shouldn't make much of it.
His comments about God not playing dice were really a response to his discomfort with quantum theory.
All right.
But it was a fundamental attitude toward the universe as well, because Einstein believed in the rationality, the comprehensibility of the universe.
Okay. Stop there, because now let me get you back to Benedict. You just said the rationality of the universe. And Benedict, in this speech at Regensburg, he quotes a medieval Byzantine emperor who is, and there's a dialogue, we have a dialogue between the Byzantine emperor and his Islamic captors. He'd been captured. And the Islam, Manuel II, it doesn't matter who he is, but he makes the argument, you must not attempt to convert by violence, by conquest, because that's an act against reason. And unreason offends against the nature of God, which is reasonable. And then the Pope, and that's in 1400 and something or others, I recall, and here's what Benedict XVI says in 2006. Is the conviction that acting unreasonably contradicts God's nature merely a Greek idea, something that occurred in Byzantine culture? Or is it always and intrinsically true? And then he gives a little exegesis, modifying the first book of Genesis, the first verse of the whole Bible. John, Gospel of John, begins the prologue of his gospel with the words, in the beginning was the Logos. And Logos, of course, means reason and word. It's the very idea that the Greeks, Hellenistic thought, places at the center of its conception of reason. John thus spoke the final word on the biblical concept of God, and in his word, all the often toilsome and torturous threads of biblical faith find their culmination and synthesis. So, in the distinctively Western Judeo-Christian tradition, I suppose one thing I'm asking is whether that tradition still lives, still informs us, still should inform us. There is no necessary contradiction between faith and reason. When Richard Dawkins, the zoologist, says, Darwin makes it possible to be an intellectually fulfilled atheist, he's talking nonsense.
This is
not easy for you. You don't like this. You don't like this line of thought.
Well, look, intellectually fulfilled atheist. I mean, how full should an intellectually fulfilled atheist really be? Must he have answers to all the questions that human beings have asked since time immemorial? Or is it sufficient that he just dismisses a great many questions and reposes in tranquility thereafter? I think Dawkins really means the latter. It gives us freedom to ignore a lot of questions. And I suppose that's true. It's true empirically. But the questions return. The murmur is always heard if you listen carefully enough. The interesting question theologically is whether rationality is an essential attribute of the deity. And bear in mind, the Islamic tradition says no.
Right.
No.
Yes.
And that is a deep, a profound difference. You only have to talk to a Muslim theologian for 5 minutes to realize how deep that runs. God is limited by nothing, including the powers of reason. And this drove a great many medieval Muslim theologians mad. Al-Ghazali, for example, he couldn't reconcile that view of the deity with anything to which he was committed in virtue of his training in Greek logic, for example. So he simply stopped talking and stopped writing. His physician said very memorably, God put a lock on his tongue. And that's the only way he could reconcile these quite different impulses.
Let me finish up Benedict and Regensburg. I'm having a lovely time just tossing these things at you and seeing what you do with them. This is the Pope. He's summing up here. This attempt, meaning his argument, painted with broad strokes at a critique of modern reason, strictly empirical scientific method, from within, has nothing to do with putting the clock back to the time before the Enlightenment and rejecting the insights of the modern age. Yet while we rejoice in the new possibilities science has opened, the material wealth we all, the sheer success of empirical science in producing new wealth for society, right? We all rejoice in that. We also see dangers, and we must ask ourselves how we can overcome them. The enemy of modern life, all right. We will succeed in doing so only if reason and faith can come together in a new way. Does David Berlinski buy this? In this sense, theology rightly belongs within the wide-ranging dialogue of the sciences, precisely as theology as an inquiry into the rationality of faith. Only thus do we become capable of genuine dialogue of cultures and religions so urgently needed today. Faith and reason, not only is there no necessary contradiction, but we ought to recognize and in some way celebrate and in some way make use of the way in which the tradition we have inherited, the Judeo-Christian tradition, sees them as linked.
Well, you know, you've got a synthesis between two imponderables. I really don't know what commitment is made when I say, or somebody else says, I have faith. I have faith in a great many things. I use that locution, for example, I have faith that tomorrow morning the sun will rise, or faith that yesterday the sun did rise. I believe in reason to the extent that I understand what people are talking about when they, you know, I believe in logic, let's put it that way. I know what a good argument is, what a bad argument, what soundness is, what validity is. Beyond that, reason seems to have very little meaning for me. So a reconciliation between two imponderables seems to me like the meanest sort of kisses sold under famine conditions. Yeah, that's what they are. The reconciliation is what it is, but it doesn't really mean anything. One thing I'm reasonably certain of is that theology as a discipline is not going to undergo a resurrection anytime soon.
It's not.
No, I don't believe
it. Because it's just not interesting enough. Why would that be?
There's a tremendous tremendous buffeting that ideas undergo. And the closest we can come to explaining them is to say that they're buffeted by taste, by changes in what we consider important. I mean, everybody who dismisses theology as a moribund science, for example, Richard Dawkins, you can be sure they're not studying it. They just know the outlines devoted to an examination of the property. It couldn't be anything that occupies an evolutionary biologist, and that's true. It's not anything that occupies an evolutionary biologist. Without a dedicated audience, the subject will perish, and that's what's happened over the last 200 years. It still exists in terms of Catholic hermeneutics. It exists in terms of different varieties of Catholic, Jewish, or Islamic doctrine. But it's not at the mainstream, and it's not going to move to the mainstream, and that's just a fact we have to accept.
That was part two of a conversation between the Hoover Institution's Peter Robinson and the Discovery Institute's David Berlinski. To dive deeper into the ideas Berlinski was unpacking here, pick up his new book, Human Nature, available from Discovery Institute Press, Barnes & Noble Online, and Amazon. Here's what Yale's David Gerlinter had to say about the work. If I were assembling a list of essential modern books for undergraduates at my college or any college, this book would be number one. Not only would students learn a tremendous lot from this book, many would also love it. Likewise, their teachers. Again, that was praise from Yale professor David Gerlinter for David Berlinski's latest book, Human Nature. The quickest way to find the book is simply to do an online search for Berlinski and Human Nature. Pick up a copy today. For ID the Future, this has been Tom Gilson.
This program was recorded by Discovery Institute's Center for Science and Culture. ID the Future is copyright Discovery Institute. For more information, visit intelligentdesign.org and idthefuture.com.